Hi, you're listening to the EU China podcast powered by the EU China Hub, straight from Brussels, a show on which we interview important actors in the EU China relations and cover the top EU China news. Our mission is to help you to get a more nuanced picture of what is going on in the EU China relations. My name is Greg Stets, and I'm happy to have you with us. If you like our show, don't forget to subscribe and to tell your friends about us. Let's get started. Hi, here comes the EU China briefing for June 29, 2020. In today's news, we cover EU-US bilateral dialogue on China is a go. Huawei faces increasingly bumpy road ahead. EU calls out China on disinformation, but many questions remain. Changed worldviews of EU citizens after COVID-19, a study by the European Council on Foreign Relations. Germany about to start its EU presidency, goals ahead. This audio briefing is based on a briefing prepared by Flavian Berniaga and Grzegorz Stets. Enjoy! EU-US bilateral dialogue on China is a go. During the Brussels Forum video conference on June 25th, US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo agreed to join the EU-US dialogue on China suggested the week before by Josep Borrell. That is a reference to a video conference with Pompeo on June 15th, when Borrell suggested initiating a transatlantic dialogue to tackle issues related to China. At the time, the two exchanged views on China's, quote, growing assertiveness on many fronts, end of quote, but did not spend more than 20 to 25 minutes on the topic within a three-hour-long call. Borrell himself described the idea of starting a dialogue as, quote, a suggestion that I put on the table during my conclusion, but nothing more than that, end of quote. Despite initially not displaying pro-dialogue sentiments, Pompeo surprised everyone during a webinar 10 days later where he showed proactive support for the idea. He stated that the US was very interested in the proposal from the beginning and said he is hopeful teams will be put in place in the coming weeks to sort out details. While he said he did, quote, not know exactly what final shape it will take, end of quote, Pompeo indicated the basis of a dialogue would be a quote-unquote collective data set that will help develop, quote, a shared understanding of the threat posed by the CCP. From there, the EU and US can check where they overlap in demands on China and take action. Pompeo made it clear he doesn't want the dialogue to be a, quote, an outlet for energy with no action, but rather a catalyst for action. End of quote. The change of heart may be owed to both domestic developments for the Trump administration and the EU's stance in its summit with China last week. During the EU-China summit last week, the EU displayed its discontent on human rights, disinformation, and the uneven playing field. These topics were repeatedly mentioned by Pompeo as common causes for the EU and US in the webinar on June 25th. Similarly, the inconsistency described in John Bolton's book, which blames Trump's prioritizing a trade deal that would secure his re-election over crafting a coherent policy on China, led to factional feuding and irreconcilable policy goals in the US between China hawks and free trade supporters. EU leaders are not very thrilled about working together, given Trump's past criticism of the EU, and would rather prefer to wait until after the US presidential elections rather than pushing for cooperation right now. So the takeaway here is that the EU and the US agree about the challenge posed by China, but they disagree on how to respond, which means a joint response will be difficult to craft. Recall the insights that, in December 2019, the EU supposedly politely declined US propositions of a similar type of transatlantic dialogue. At the time, EU officials tried to steer the conversation towards topical issues, for example trade or cyber, and avoid being sucked into the game of picking sides between Washington and Beijing. In the meantime, COVID-19 and the Hong Kong National Security Law matter made many European capitals rethink engagement with China. which brings us to Borrell's proposal and Margaret Vestager talking positively about working together with the US on the security of 5G. We're going to talk about it in the next news bite. Even so, don't expect transatlantic cooperation on China to flourish overnight, even if a common challenge is known. Too many differences remain. For example, while both the EU and the US may disapprove of the situation in Hong Kong, Washington took steps that were decisively more antagonistic, for example, imposing visa restrictions on selected Chinese officials. Also, John Bolton's book showed that Trump pleaded with Xi Jinping to settle on a favorable trade deal so he could win re-election. This will leave the EU reticent to collaborate with a US president who's simultaneously abrasive and transactional. So cooperation will likely emerge on targeted issues following intense negotiations, and Brussels will be watching closely the November US presidential election in order to make a decision on the degree of its cooperation with the US. Huawei faces increasingly bumpy road ahead. Multiple states and actors have undertaken measures to restrict high-risk 5G providers, which deals important setbacks to Huawei's attempt to enter European markets. Importantly, in the EU context, the Belgian government is set to issue important curbs on high-risk 5G equipment vendors. This decision suggests that Huawei would not be allowed to develop 5G infrastructure in areas where EU or NATO buildings are stationed. Most importantly, no high-risk vendors will be able to offer their services in the core parts of the Belgian 5G network. In a similar vein, outside of the core parts, only 35% of the equipment could come from high-risk providers. The Belgian government followed the Commission's 5G toolbox, in which high-risk vendors means suppliers that may be subject to interference from a non-EU country. This may happen because of intelligence laws, government control, or lack of, quote, democratic checks and balances, end of quote. However, Huawei and ZTE already provide equipment for certain Belgian telecoms. As such, the law will provide them a window of 5 years to fall in line with the renewed standards. New 5G equipment will have to respect these rules from day one. Moving on to another part of this story. In a Brussels Forum webinar, alongside US Senator Mark Warner, Commissioner Vice President Margaret Vestager made explicit calls for the EU and US to work on 5G matters together. This came one day after Mike Pompeo said in a statement that Huawei is facing less business because countries do not trust high-risk vendors. Within that statement, he offered, among others, the examples of 8 EU countries: Czech Republic, Poland, Sweden, Estonia, Romania, Denmark, Latvia, and Greece. During the Brussels Forum webinar, Vestager said the security of 5G networks is essential for digitalization and argued, quote, "We have to work together and push for the things that we believe in to be maintained and developed within our line of values," end of quote. She also expressed her wish that a future digital society will not be a surveillance state and pleaded that the EU and US, quote, "will have a much better chance of success if they work together," end of quote. But this week, we've also seen some interesting developments regarding Huawei happening in the UK. Huawei received the okay to build a massive chip factory in the United Kingdom, but it faces the prospect of being removed from the market. On June 25th, Huawei was approved to build a $1.25 billion, budgeted over 3 years, research facility in Cambridge as the international headquarters of its fiber optic communication business and chip research and manufacturing facility. However, remember that at the beginning of June, Boris Johnson signaled he wanted full decoupling of Huawei from the UK telecom by 2023. Now the House of Lords is backing a cross-party amendment to the Telecommunications Infrastructure Bill that would create a human rights standard for the installation of 5G technology in leasehold flats. Also, on June 25th, Ericsson's president, Arun Bansal, said that in the scenario where the British government bans Huawei, his company, which is not considered high risk, is ready to meet demand if needed. Moving on to the takeaways. First of all, out of the 8 countries that Pompeo mentioned, 7 are NATO members and 5 are NATO members in Central and Eastern Europe. This is not a coincidence. The US has already become a central player in discussions on 5G in Central and Eastern Europe, and countries that feel strongly about NATO are also very likely to adopt memorandums and joint declarations that are not favorable to Huawei. You can find examples of such joint declarations with the US that were signed by Estonia, Poland, and Romania on our website. On the one hand, there is a legitimate connection between security threats and a belief in NATO, but this is adjoined by a pragmatic train of thought which prioritizes NATO and relationships with US over potential relationship with China. Another takeaway is that progress on implementation of the EU 5G toolbox should be reviewed by the end of June, but there have been no significant updates on the matter lately. In the meantime, we can take a look at some interesting examples. For instance, Hungary included telecommunication challenges in its recent national security document. Although, we're unlikely to see any large debates or bans on Huawei, as we discussed with Tamás Matura. More specifically, the final pages of the National Security Strategies chapter on China raised 3 important risks for Hungarian security services. 1. Rising China's influence in the Central European region. 2. Chinese superiority in high technology, and 3. Chinese investment in critical infrastructure. It is hard to decipher whether they were put there by Budapest as a result of the Commission's recommendations on 5G or because American partners asked them to do so. But it is nonetheless a step Hungary had not taken before, and we encourage you to listen to our conversation with Tamás, which you can find on our website. EU calls out China on disinformation, but many questions remain. On June 22nd, following the EU-China summit, Ursula von der Leyen suggested that China is responsible for cyber attacks on essential services and the spread of disinformation. During the press conference following the summit, von der Leyen said she pointed out to her counterparts that China has been the source of cyber attacks on hospitals in Europe during the pandemic, something which, quote, cannot be tolerated, end of quote. This comes after NATO members announced in early June that malicious cyber activities were directed against hospitals, healthcare services, and research institutes. It also comes after similar, albeit less direct, remarks by High Representative Borrell in April. But in both of those cases, fingers were not pointed at any specific actors. Throughout the pandemic, authorities from France, the Czech Republic, Germany, Spain, Slovakia, as well as from the WTO, publicly decried large-scale cyber attacks, including phishing and malware distribution, Trojans, scanning activities, and distributed denial-of-service attacks. Von der Leyen also criticized China for its disinformation campaign during the pandemic, accusing it of targeted influence operations, campaigns to portray the EU as weak in fighting COVID-19, and attempts to nurture social polarization. Her remarks were in line with the joint communication on disinformation of the European Commission, which we reported about last week. Before the announcement of this joint communication, Commission Vice President Vera Jourova expressed her support for the announcement. Quote, "We have, for the first time, decided to name China in our report. I'm glad we did this, because if we have evidence, we must say it. It is time to tell the truth." End of quote. But Chinese officials rejected von der Leyen's claims on June 23rd and asked the EU to provide proof as a basis for accusations. A spokesperson of the Chinese mission to the EU called von der Leyen's comments, quote, "completely unacceptable," end of quote, and reaffirmed China's opposition to any type of cyber attack. Nonetheless, a European Commission spokesperson declined to offer more details, citing the inability to disclose information on security incidents. This has confused analysts who argue von der Leyen made big claims without providing insights into where the incidents occurred, what was China's role in those incidents, and how much coordination happened between the Commission and the member states. But there is also a broader money issue here. It seems that not enough resources are dedicated within the EU to fight disinformation. The budget of the Disinformation Analysis Branch of the European External Action Service, which stands at 6 million euros, will be depleted at the end of the year, and there are no current provisions from the Parliament to replenish it. More worryingly, the current budget is smaller than even the budgets of Russia Today in Russia or CGTN in China. Three Commission officials said more resources will be provided, but negotiations have not started and their final form will depend on the member states' approval. This is problematic, given that some states prefer to avoid pointing fingers at China. And there is also precedence to such problems. When the EU sought to tackle Russian disinformation, member states negotiated for 2 years because some countries did not want to break economic ties with Russia. Economic ties with Beijing are more important than those with Moscow, so this problem is likely to re-emerge. Two EU officials said the issue is even more complex now, since China does not employ the same tactics as Russia, and the head of one of the units at European External Action Service indicated the EU should distinguish between propaganda and disinformation. Moving to the takeaways. The EU is not the sole party worried by disinformation and cyber attacks from China, and that is good news for policymakers in Brussels. As indicated in Newsbyte 1, Pompeo mentioned disinformation as one of the main reasons why the EU and US should establish a dialogue on China. Furthermore, Jens Stoltenberg's remarks on NATO needing to reorient on the challenges posed by China further shows that the EU can establish cooperation partnerships with both the US and the UK within NATO if it wants to compensate for its budgetary deficiencies. This would allow to pool resources, share information, and establish a more streamlined response procedure to cyber attacks and disinformation. At the same time, it would likely provide NATO with renewed impetus and could convince Donald Trump that NATO is worth upholding. Understandably, working with the Trump administration on tackling disinformation will be difficult in itself, as the American president has been at the receiving end of criticism for spreading false information. Changed worldviews of EU citizens after COVID-19, a study by the European Council on Foreign Relations. On June 24, the European Council on Foreign Relations issued a report on how the pandemic impacted EU citizens' views on politics, society, and Europe's place in the world. The report, written by Ivan Krastev and Mark Leonard, studies the changes in EU public opinion on politics and society following the pandemic. The study was done on 11,000 people coming from 9 countries: Bulgaria, Denmark, France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Portugal, Spain, and Sweden, which encompass 2/3 of the EU's population and GDP. Previously, many claimed that the virus gave impetus to more powers for the state, and that it restored trust in experts, and that it empowered and widened the divisions between Eurosceptics and Europhiles. However, the study disproves these beliefs. Results of the study grouped previously held beliefs into 3 categories, called illusions, and organized citizens into 3 camps depending on their mindset related to Europe's role in the world: DIYers, New Cold Warriors, and Strategic Sovereigntists. Illusion 1 referred to the belief that the pandemic has caused the public to support a greater role for the state. This is debunked, as the virus has not changed voting attitudes on the role of the state and has not created new political cleavages. Illusion 2 is the belief that the crisis led to a surge of trust in experts. However, only 35% of interviewees expressed positive attitudes towards experts, with the rest assuming they are intertwined in political manipulation and instrumentalization. Illusion 3 refers to the paradoxical belief that COVID-19 has led to increase in popularity of both Eurosceptics and supporters of European federalism. Nonetheless, the virus did not result in the same ethnicity-based nationalism as the migration crisis. Instead, a new wave of nationalism is based on country residence. At the same time, a significant number of people thought the EU responded poorly to the crisis. When asked about Europe's place in the world, particularly in relation to the US and China, respondents were grouped as DIYers, people who believe the post-COVID-19 world is akin to the 19th century, with nation-states having the capacity to follow their own interests outside of multilateral frameworks; New Cold Warriors, so people who see China as the major threat and look towards the US for 20th century-style protection; and finally, Strategic Sovereignists, so people who expect a deglobalized post-COVID-19 world that will split into blocs and regions. And these people are progressive protectionists who argue the EU will only remain relevant if its countries have greater powers and act together. Strategic Sovereignists form the majority, around 42%, with DIYers and New Cold Warriors getting 29% and 15% respectively. The Sovereignists comprise both former nationalists who understand that there are two kinds of countries in Europe, the small ones and the ones that don't yet realize they are small, and former globalists who grew disillusioned with world politics dictated by Trump, Putin and Xi. Interestingly, Germany is predominantly DIYers, while the strongest strategic sovereignty trend can be found in Portugal, Poland and Spain. Moving on to what does it mean for the European integrity? While some have suggested that we're in the midst of a Hamiltonian moment, which is a reference to the first US Secretary of the Treasury who mutualized the debt of former colonies after the US War of Independence, the study finds that countries instrumentalize the EU as a tool to protect the nation-state. The Franco-German agreement on a recovery plan was seen by some as a proto-federalization moment, but instead strong national identities emerged, asking for protection from the state, not the supra-state. However, the post-pandemic recovery still has the potential to be the launchpad for a United States of Europe. For this to happen, EU leaders must craft policy in a manner that displays Europe assuming back sovereignty and fending off challenges from both Beijing and Washington. Speaking of that, what about China and the US within this picture? The COVID-19 pandemic inflicted significant damage to China's reputation in Europe, but a similar process has happened with the United States. Over 50% Germans and over 60% of French and Danish respondents said their opinion on China worsened, which they tie to the virus origin and the aggressive diplomacy and disinformation stemming from Beijing after the pandemic. Surprisingly, similar stats exist for the US. 64% of Spaniards, 65% of Germans, and over 70% of Danes and Portuguese have a worse opinion of the US. Aside from the catastrophic crisis response, this also seems to be linked to a broader question. If the US cannot solve its own problems, how can the quote-unquote broken hegemon help anyone else? We highly encourage you to read the study itself, but you can find the most relevant graphs on our website. Moving on to the takeaways. First of all, the joint response to the crisis presents the EU with an opportunity to further boost the bloc's integration. Nonetheless, the European leaders who would like to push for deeper integration would be better off understanding the public's mood, which the ECFR's study outlines in detail. The most important aspect is to differentiate between what the study calls the Hamiltonian moment and the Millward moment. Much of the debate in past months has focused on the former US Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, and the parallels between the current situation and his mutualization of the debt of former British colonies after the American War of Independence. The reality is that we're in the midst of a Millward moment. This is a reference to British historian Alan Millward, who argued in the 1950s that the European project helped national sovereignty recover rather than undermine it. Instead of an idealistic belief in integration, the current mood appears to be a pragmatic one, related to joint security in the face of common external challenges. Very realistically, if countries remain divided, they won't stand a chance in the increasingly multipolar world. That is also why we highly encourage you to read the full results of this very important study by ECFR. Moving on to the next takeaway. Speaking of deeper integration, the first big hurdle is the stall in negotiations on the next EU budget and next generation EU recovery fund, as we covered in our last briefing. The opportunity to bring more competences for the Commission and maybe even change the treaties is gigantic, but such opportunity requires a level of political will that appears to be sorely missing from some EU leaders. Macron and Merkel have undertaken large efforts to ensure that frugal four disagreement does not hinder a more ambitious final proposal. In this context, the German presidency could be considered the right person at the right time, because it can use its leverage as chair of the Council to steer the discussion on further integration. Even so, the task at hand is difficult, and no matter how much lobbying comes from Brussels, Berlin, or Paris, it is ultimately up to all the leaders to realize that deeper integration is not just the liberal motto of Europhiles of a couple of years ago, but instead has become a pragmatic necessity. Germany about to start its EU presidency. Goals ahead. On July 1st, Germany will be assuming for 6 months the rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union, time in which it will try to be, quote, the motor and moderator of Europe, end of quote, according to Foreign Minister Heiko Maas. As Germany is gearing to take the Council torch from Croatia, it announced its presidency program and trio program, alongside Portugal and Slovenia. The central focus outlined in the trio program will be overcoming the COVID-19 pandemic, meaning, quote, the virus must be curbed, the European economy must recover, and social cohesion in Europe must be reinforced, end of quote. At the same time, finding consensus on the EU Economic Recovery Fund and the 7-year budget will be Germany's most important urgent task, so that the final drafts will be approved by December 2020. The program also highlights Germany's focus on climate change and digitalization, quote, the great transformation processes of our time, end of quote. This falls in line with the Commission's wish to have a green and digital economic recovery after the pandemic. When it comes to what Germany's program can tell us about relations with China, they are supposed to be the foreign policy priority of the program. In the draft of the presidency program seen by Reuters on June 15th, Germany adopted a tougher stance on its expectations from China. Specifically, the draft of the program signals that Germany wants to work with China for, quote, more reciprocity in all areas, end of quote. Similarly, it indicates, quote, the China policy of all EU institutions and member states should be united and balanced and be oriented towards long-term common EU interests and values, end of quote. This reference to values is particularly important since it was not present in earlier versions of the draft. Its introduction comes in the context of the Hong Kong National Security Law controversy and the European Parliament's resolution on Hong Kong. The document also mentions climate change and the establishment of a, quote, greater level playing field in terms of competition, end of quote, as objectives, but contains no mention of human rights or democracy. And let's quickly discuss what Germany's leader has to say ahead of the German presidency. In a series of interviews across multiple newspapers in Europe, Angela Merkel outlined a pragmatic approach to the German presidency's strategy on China. She warned that, quote, the example of China shows that even an undemocratic state can be economically successful, which is a major challenge for our liberal democracies, end of quote. Nonetheless, Merkel contended that China remains a partner in economic and environmental matters. She also pointed out that the end of history predicted in the 1990s did not materialize. Quote, we have not yet been able to furnish absolute proof that the liberal system is about to win the day, end of quote, and alluded to the war in the Balkans, terrorism and the rise of ISIS, and more recently, China's rise as having dealt important blows to hopes of a liberal international order. Merkel restated that the EU wants to have a summit with China, originally scheduled for Leipzig in September 2020 but postponed until further notice given the pandemic, but argued that the joint summit, which would see the 27 EU leaders meeting directly with Xi Jinping, will force EU member states to, quote, develop a policy that reflects our interests and values, end of quote. Asked whether the time has come for the EU to assume strategic autonomy, Merkel reaffirmed a commitment to transatlanticism, but asserted that Europe's role needs to be more important, especially in the scenario of a US withdrawing from the role of world power. Moving on to the takeaways. The message coming from German official statements and the adjustment of documents is one of increasing assertiveness and recognition of the challenge of systemic rivalry. Nonetheless, the EU is likely to continue with developing this response in an evolutionary rather than revolutionary manner. The 6 months of German presidency will overlap both with the election in the US in November and potentially the postponed Leipzig summit, which is not necessarily going to take place in Leipzig. These events will provide new clarity on EU-China relations, mainly by showing whether EU countries are able to come up with a coherent, more united strategy towards China ahead of the postponed summit, and whether the EU will have to deal with 4 more years of Donald Trump in the office. If that becomes the case, a transatlantic dialogue would be unlikely to result in much concrete action, and the drift between Washington and Brussels will likely widen, while relations with Beijing would be approached from a perspective of realistic cooperation. How much realism will be injected into this cooperation will also depend on actions from China. That's it for this week's briefing. See you next time. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the EU-China podcast. If you want to know more or to get in touch with us, visit our website, which is euchinahub.com. And if you find this show insightful, be sure to leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice. It will help others to get to know about us. See you next time.